Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back to Perimeter. And I want to thank the organizers for putting together this conference in such a creative manner. It's quite exciting. And also thanking them for inviting me to speak here. The title of my talk, as you can read, is Eminent Symmetries. The goal of the talk is to explain what the title means. And this term, in physics at least, well, it's an English word, but in physics at least, it was introduced first in a paper I wrote this November with Monk Cheng. He's a card-carrying condensed matter physicist. I'm not. But the bulk of I'll talk a little bit about that, but the bulk of the talk will be a paper written earlier this month with Shuheng Shao and two more follow-up papers that hopefully will appear soon. And a special thanks to Tom Banks for participating in the earlier stages of this project, and more importantly, for suggesting the word eminent, which was clearly outside my English vocabulary. When he suggested that, I told him I need a term for that. I need an English term. So I got that email. That evening, I got an email from him. The word you need is eminent. So I had to look it up, and it's really quite perfect for reasons that you will soon see. So let's start with the talk. So there's an eminent symmetry. Let's first discuss the symmetry. So we're talking about global symmetries. Gauge symmetries are not really symmetries. And we should really distinguish the theory in the UV and in the IR. And one way to think about it is the UV could be a lattice, it could be quantum gravity, some other continuum field theory, what have you. And in the IR, we have some continuum field theory, and we would like to match them. And the symmetries don't have to be the same. So for simplicity, let me talk here about the symmetry group. Later, we will also discuss non-invertible symmetries, so they don't form a group. So every internal symmetry operator in the UV satisfies some conditions to be a symmetry, is a true symmetry of the theory, and therefore it's also a symmetry in the IR. So we have a map from every symmetry operator in the UV to a symmetry operator in the IR, but this map is a homomorphism. It's a homomorphism rather than an isomorphism because there could be symmetries in the UV that act trivially in the IR. They just act only on heavy states, they don't act on light states. More interesting for us, a new symmetry is that appear in the IR and are not present in the UV. And usually they come under the name of emergent symmetries or accidental symmetries. In condensed matter physics, they are referred to as emergent symmetries because they emerge from nowhere. And in high energy physics, they are called accidental symmetries because it's an accident that they are there. And the reason the accident arises is that when we write the low energy effective theory, we write the low energy effective Lagrangian or Hamiltonian, we impose only the UV symmetry. And then surprisingly or accidentally, we realize that among the list of GUV preserving operators, all the relevant operators preserve a larger symmetry. And then we say that the larger symmetry is there at long distances, but not microscopically. And a typical example to keep in mind is B minus L in the standard model of particle physics. That's an emergent or an accidental symmetry. Another aspect of emergent symmetries is that they are not important, they are not sacred, there's nothing fundamental about them. They are not even there in the UV. So they could be, and they are, violated by irrelevant operators. And indeed, B minus L is such an example. And people do measurements, checking violations of B minus L. And that's really going after these irrelevant operators, telling us that neutrinos are massive, et cetera, et cetera. So accidental or emergent symmetries are some kind of accident. They are not precise. I'm not going to talk about them in this talk. This is to be distinguished from eminent symmetries. So I'll give you the color coding. This color will be always for the UV. It's not violet. It's kind of purplish. This is my infrared. If I use ultraviolet and infrared, you couldn't tell the difference between them. And I will also use this color for eminent symmetries. So this would be the color coding for the rest of the talk. So how can we have symmetries that are not there in the UV, but do exist in the IR? And the important thing to remember is that there are exact symmetries in the IR theory. So the IR theory can exhibit exact global symmetries that are not symmetries in the UV. It sounds almost impossible, but it's actually quite common. So they typically arise from some other symmetry. For example, UV translation, and hence the word emanates. They emanate from the UV symmetry, but they are not exactly the same symmetry. Hence, they are eminent symmetries. And unlike the emergent symmetries, there typically are relevant operators that violate the eminent symmetry. There exist such operators, but they are not present in the Lagrangian. Similarly, there are typically lots, an infinite number of irrelevant operators violating this symmetry, and they are also not present in the Lagrangian. So the low-energy theory has an exact symmetry. This eminent symmetry is an exact symmetry of the low-energy theory. The way I presented it here, it sounds almost impossible. How can we have not an approximate, but an exact symmetry which does not exist microscopically? So this symmetry is quite sacred because it's exact. And if it has anomalies, we should have anomaly matching condition for eminent symmetries. And we'll see examples of that. In fact, there are lots of known examples, and hence I wrote here old wine in a new bottle. There are lots of known examples which were not phrased in those many words. And I've talked to a lot of people who are familiar with the background, and I confirmed that nobody quite said it in this way. So some examples that were discussed in detail in the paper with Monk Cheng are a system with a global U1 symmetry in the presence of a chemical potential. This system has an eminent symmetry. In fact, it has an anomalous eminent symmetry, which has important consequences in the infrared. Another example is various spin models, like the Heisenberg chain that figured earlier this morning in the talk this morning. And what I will do today is talk about lattice fermions as just as another example to demonstrate what I'm talking about. So I talk about the Majorana chain, and this is a very well-studied model. So I decided not to give references. The history of this model is extremely long. And we have a chain, a lattice in one dimension, with big L sites, so a big L sites. And on every site, I put a real fermion, and I impose periodic boundary conditions. We will soon also consider antiperiodic boundary conditions. And I specify the theory by saying that these fermions satisfy a Clifford algebra. That's almost the entire input. The rest of the input is imposing a translation symmetry, shifting the lattice by one site, and also fermion parity, so that all the terms in the Hamiltonian have an have an even number of fermions. So that's the input. To have a concrete example in mind, we can study this Hamiltonian of nearest neighbors. So this Hamiltonian is really easy to diagonalize. It's exactly solvable. We'll soon do that. But most of what I'm going to say is independent of that. And we can have quartic couplings, next to nearest neighbors, et cetera. We can make the Hamiltonian arbitrarily complicated, provided these two facts are preserved. We can also introduce a fermion parity defect by flipping one term in the Hamiltonian, say the last one, chi 1, chi a. This is equivalent to saying that the fermions, the original fermions, have not periodic but antiperiodic boundary conditions. So we are going to study these two models in parallel, the one with periodic and the one with antiperiodic boundary conditions, and I'll refer to them as H plus and H minus, respectively. But as I keep emphasizing, most of the discussion will be independent of the details of the fermions. We are going to find four fermionic theories. First, whether we discuss periodic or antiperiodic boundary conditions. And second, whether L, the number of sites, is even or odd. So altogether, there are four theories. All of them have already been beaten to death over the last several decades, so that's not new. For even L, H minus leads in the continuum to the Neve-Schwarz Majorana CFT. And H plus leads to the Ramon Majorana CFT. It's almost clear from this picture. What's a little bit more interesting is what we do with L odd. Most people refuse to discuss L odd because they say this theory is inconsistent. We can discuss that in more detail. But what I would argue is that one should think of this theory as being the Ramon Neve-Schwarz or the Neve-Schwarz Ramon theory. That I'm using here the high energy physics terminology. So let's discuss this model in more detail. There are two symmetries generated by lattice translation, denoted by T, and I'm consistent with my color coding. That's anything in the UV has this color. And we also have fermion parity, which is minus 1 to the F. If the sign is minus, namely the fermions are antiperiodic, these two lattice operators satisfy the symmetry algebra. T raised to the number of sites is minus 1 to the f. This is the statement that we have antiperiodic boundary conditions. And fermion parity commutes with lattice translation. That's kind of the obvious one. So that's the easy one. H plus is a little bit more interesting. First, we don't have minus 1 to the f on the right-hand side here. But more interestingly, we have a minus sign here. That was first noticed, as far as I know, by these people. So the lattice translation anti-commutes with fermion parity. So we are going to interpret this minus sign as reflecting an anomaly, a mixed anomaly between fermion parity and lattice translation. So the lattice problem with finite L, L has only has to be even, so L equals 4 or 6, has an anomaly mixing lattice translation with fermion parity. But this immediately raises a question. We go to long distance, we make L big, we go to low energies, we find the continuum theory. Everybody knows there is no anomaly involving translation at long in the continuum theory. So how can we possibly have a toothed anomaly matching if in the UV we have anomaly between translation and something, and there is no such anomaly in the continuum? I will answer this question. So let's solve this model. So let's be interested in this specific model so we can solve it. We go to momentum modes. We find a dispersion relation. This is the energy as a function of the momentum. I normalize the momentum k such that it's always an integer. And for the difference between H plus and H minus, the main difference is that H plus has two fermion zero modes denoted by the red dots here. And if I'm at low energies, looking, say, at energies below this line here, I see two modes with linear dispersion relation. One is here, and one is here. So a low energy person with limited amount of energy says, what we see here is right movers and left movers. They arise from the two end of the spectrum. And if I just look at one end, I should really measure momentum relative to zero at this end and relative to L over 2 at this end. These guys have positive momentum. These guys have negative momentum. And as long as I'm trying computing processes at low energy and all my operators have low momentum, there is no transition from one side to the other. So I have a conserved charge, unless there is an operator that takes us from one to the other. I'll soon make that statement more precise. And if we just look at the spectrum, we see that H plus leads to the Ramon-Ramon spectrum, and H minus leads to the Neve-Schwartz-Neve-Schwartz spectrum. The algebra that needs to be done here is field theory 101. So this is a step that when you first learn field theory and you go to normal modes and you do that, it's exactly the same algebra. Now, on the lattice, we have only minus 1 to the f. There is no minus 1 to the f left and no minus 1 to the f right. So that immediately raises a question. On the lattice, we have only minus 1 to the f symmetry. Why is it that we have massless fermions at long distances? I didn't fine-tune anything. We landed on the massless theory, and there could have been a fermion mass term at long distances. This respects minus 1 to the f. Yet, the macroscopic theory has a new symmetry, minus 1 to the f left, and of course also minus 1 to the f right, which is an exact symmetry at low energies. How did this come about? So, let me just say the answer. Minus 1 to the f left would be an eminent symmetry, an exact symmetry that appears in the infrared, which is not there in the IR. Sorry, appears in the IR, which is not there in the infrared. So concretely, let's focus on H plus. This is the Ramon-Ramon theory. At short distances, we have minus 1 to the f, and translation symmetry, whose lth power is 1. This is the symmetry algebra. As a group, it's ZL. We have a ZL symmetry. But I claim that at long distances, we can focus on that part of the spectrum, or that part of the spectrum, and have a new symmetry. I measure P plus, this is the momentum, measured relative to 0 here and measured relative to L over 2 here. And there's another minus sign in this exponential coming here from this minus 1 to the f left. So at short distances, we have only one symmetry operator. At long distances, there are two separately meaningful symmetry operators. So P plus is the momentum of the continuum theory. And on the lattice, only T plus is well defined. But in the continuum, we have two conserved quantities. Both of them are meaningful, both the momentum and minus 1 to the f left. Both of them are exact symmetries. The reason is that as long as we don't go up here, we can really assign for every particle whether it's coming from this part of the spectrum or that part of the spectrum. This is ambiguous only for states around here, but states around here take a lot of energy and a lot of momentum, and that's why this symmetry is exact. Furthermore, this operator relation that I postulated above, how the translation operator is given in terms of minus one to the f left in this exponential, is exact. This is very rare. Usually, when we have a continuum theory and a lattice model, the expression on the lattice in terms of the continuum suffers from finite size corrections. There could be 1 over L, 1 over L squared. There could be higher order corrections. Here, such a thing is not possible because if we raise this object to the Lth power, we should get 1. So if we try to put here 1 over L squared corrections, we'll mess up this equation. And therefore, this equation must be an exact equation, an exact relation between the lattice and the continuum. Furthermore, now we get a bonus. So I claim that the reason the fermion is massless is that we get this eminent chiral symmetry. And in the continuum, so we also had the result on the lattice that minus 1 to the f anti-commutes with lattice translation. That is not something we can do using continuum quantities because there is no anomaly in translation in the continuum. But lattice translation in the continuum becomes both continuous translation and a Z2 chiral symmetry. And in the continuum theory, we do have a mixed anomaly between minus 1 to the f and minus 1 to the f left. The oldest paper I found on the subject is this one, but there could very well be others, and there are other papers later that mention it. So in the continuum, we have this anomaly between internal symmetries, and that's the way the IR matches the anomaly in the UV. Now, similarly, we can do H minus. For simplicity, I will not go through it. This is the theory in the Nevis-Schwartz theory. I will soon use it. Let's go to odd L. This is the one that is hardest to quantize, and some people say it doesn't make sense, and other people say it's anomalous or it exists only as a relative theory. I'll take a very conservative view. I just said I have these chis. They satisfy the Clifford algebra, and I'm looking for the smallest dimensional representation that can realize the algebra. In this case, there's no minus 1 to the f. You'll know about that if you studied Clifford algebras with an odd number of elements. There's no gamma 5. So there's no minus 1 to the f. And there's no chiral symmetry. So the symmetry of this model is only lattice translation. There's also parity. Sorry, there's no parity in this case either. So there's no symmetry, other symmetry rather than translation. And I'm not going to explain it in detail here, but if you raise t to the Lth power, you find an anomaly, you find this phase. This will take some time to explain. So this model, at short distances, has only translation and translation with this anomaly. So let's diagonalize the Hamiltonian. We'll do what we did before. We go to normal modes and we look at the spectrum. H plus is depicted here on the left. H minus is depicted here to the right. Again, we are going to look at low energies and find two branches of the dispersion relation, leading to right movers and left movers. And unlike the previous problem, now we have a zero mode in H plus, a single zero mode at momentum zero. And for H minus, we have a single zero mode at L over 2, which is around here. So just working out the analysis, we see that H plus leads to the Nevis-Schwartz-Ramon theory, and H minus leads to the RNS theory. Now, let's discuss the symmetries in more detail. On the lattice, there is no internal symmetry. No minus 1 to the f left, no minus 1 to the f right, and no minus 1 to the f. No internal symmetries. What do we have at long distances? Well, it's the repeat of the previous story. We get a new chiral symmetry, assigning plus 1 to the modes here, and assigning minus 1 to the modes here. This symmetry emanates from T plus. And this is the algebra they satisfy. I already mentioned this equation. And this is how the lattice expression is expressed in terms of the continuum expressions. So again, the color coding, this is UV, this is IR, and this special color green is the eminent symmetry. If you know your conformal field theory well enough in the continuum, you should recognize this equation as the correct answer in the continuum. And again, I've copied from the previous slide, the momentum of the continuum theory is well defined only at low energies. Not well defined on the lattice. On the lattice, only T is well defined, but in the continuum, both minus 1 to the f left and the momentum are separately meaningful and separately conserved. And as in the previous case, this relation between these quantities is an exact relation without a finite L corrections. And it's not too much work to do now H minus. All we need to do is flip plus and minus and fermion left with fermion right, and we end up with the Ramon-Nevish-Watts theory. So this is what I wanted to say about the fermionic theory. Now, we should bosonize it. And the way we will do that is not the way usually done in condensed matter physics, although it's kind of equivalent to it. We will just follow our nose and do the GSO projection the way it's normally being done. So what should we do? We make the Hilbert space bigger. We take a direct sum of two theories, the Nevish-Watts-Nevish-Watts and the Ramon theory, or the Nevish-Watts-Ramon and the Ramon theory, and the Ramon-Nevish-Watts. And so we find a larger Hilbert space. Everything in the larger Hilbert space will have a tilde on top of it. So this is doubling the Hilbert space. And we take the Hamiltonian to be block diagonal. This is the Hamiltonian of the Nevish-Watts-Nevish-Watts part of the theory, and this is the Hamiltonian of the Ramon-Ramon, of the antiperiodic and periodic. So that's what I wrote here. And now we have a translation symmetry, the same translation symmetry we had before. We shift the antiperiodic fermions with T minus, and we shift the periodic fermions with T plus. And furthermore, since we double the Hilbert space, we have what is sometimes referred to as the quantum Z2 symmetry. We're just doing the same thing we always do with orbifolds. We have the theory and the untwisted and the twisted sector, so we have a new Z2 symmetry that gives them charges plus and minus one, and I'll call it eta tilde, and tilde is there because it is in the big Hilbert space. So if we look at these the operators that we're at, this is a big finite dimensional Hilbert space. All the operators are matrices that act in this Hilbert space. Everything manifestly makes sense. But when we start discussing locality, we see that some set of operators is not local relative to others. So we just imitate what we do in the continuum. We need to perform the GSO projection, right? We did taking the Nevish-Watts-Nevish-Watts and the Ramon-Ramon separately. So now we perform the projection. If we perform the projection on eta tilde minus 1 to the f equals plus 1, we end up with the Ising model. So we take the big Hilbert space, we perform the projection, and we find the Hilbert space of the Ising model. And then we can perform a Jordan-Wigner transformation and express the result as it's normally being done. It's called the transverse field Ising model at the critical point, where X and Y and Z are the Pauli matrices at the sites J. Notice that the number of sites that we have now is half what we had before. We had L fermions, L was even, L was 2n. Before we had nearest neighbors with an even number, with twice as many sites. Now we have half as many sites, only J goes from 1 to N. And similarly, we can perform the projection here with a minus sign. If we perform the projection with a minus sign, some signs here get changed. In fact, only this sign gets flipped. And this is the Ising model with a Z2 defect. Now, what are the symmetries of this model? Microscopically, we had translation. But recall the anomaly that we had. T minus commutes with minus 1 to the f, but T plus does anti-commute with minus 1 to the f. So if we kind of gauge minus 1 to the f, we are going to lose T plus. T plus is no longer a symmetry after the projection. In other words, T plus does not commute with the projection, and therefore T tilde is not a symmetry of our problem. T tilde square is a symmetry, and eta tilde, they commute with the projection, and therefore we can reduce them to the projected Hilbert space and find lattice translation for Ising and the Z2 of Ising, and they satisfy this algebra. Note again, the translation of Ising is the square of translations of the Majoranas because we have twice as many Majoranas and we have Isings. But what about this lattice translation? Does it give us anything new? It was an exact symmetry in the Majorana case when we had the fermions. And can we get anything useful out of it? So this way, we can't get anything useful out of it because T plus anti-commutes with it. However, let me put zero here. If I put zero here, I consider this operator, it commutes with the projection operator, and hence it acts in the Hilbert space of the Ising model. So starting from the fermions, it's clear that this has to be a symmetry. So this is a new symmetry of the lattice Ising model. And we checked very carefully. Nobody wrote down this symmetry, which is kind of surprising because the transverse field Ising model has been with us for many, many decades. So we have a new non-invertible symmetry on the lattice. It's non-invertible because we have a zero here. If we square it, T minus square is Ising, the translation of Ising, I already said that. And the zero here means that we have a projection operator with a Z2 charge. So we have 1 plus eta. So this is a new symmetry of the Ising model. It can be expressed in terms of the local operators, sigma x, sigma y, sigma z, etc. It commutes with the Hamiltonian. It's a perfectly good symmetry, except that it's not invertible. And you can check that it exists for whenever L is even. So you can have L being 2 or 4, and you have this symmetry. Now let's take the continuum limit. We take the continuum limit, this guy flows to a known non-invertible symmetry of the continuum Ising model. This is a partial list of references of people who studied this non-invertible symmetry of the continuum theory. And it satisfies the following algebra. This line is what appears in the continuum. So d squared is 1 plus eta is a projection operator. Eta squared is 1. This is the same Z2 of Ising. And d with eta on both sides gives us d. And this is the continuum translation. And this is, again, the relation between the lattice quantity on the left and the continuum quantities on the right. Notice that the two algebras are different. The algebra satisfied by the non-invertible symmetry on the lattice is not the same as the algebra satisfied in the continuum. Therefore, when we talk about the symmetry in the continuum, it's not the same symmetry. And this curly D in green should be called an eminent symmetry because it's not the symmetry that we had on the lattice. So we have this eminent symmetry. And as we said before, it is exact in the infrared. It's an exact symmetry infrared, not even violated by irrelevant operators. And on the lattice, we have only D and T Ising. In the continuum, we have P and D and all the other symmetries that come with it. And of course, also eta. And as before, this relation between the lattice quantity and the continuum quantity is exact. So far, L was even. Let me spend one slide on odd L. So in this case, no projection is needed. And in fact, minus 1 to the F doesn't even exist. So we can follow our nose and do the same thing. And we end up with this Hamiltonian for Ising. So most of the terms are exactly the same as in the Ising model, except near the end, there's another term here, and there's also one Z that is missing. So locally, only one neighborhood of the lattice was modified. And this particular model had been studied earlier by these authors. And they identified this model as being the Ising model with a Kramer-Venier duality on the lattice. So now things make a lot of sense. We have a new symmetry on the lattice, this D. We have a new symmetry on the lattice, there has to be a new defect associated with it. So this is the Hamiltonian with the defect. What we had before was the operator, we discussed the operator in the untwisted Hilbert space. So this model flows in the continuum to another known Ising CFT with a non-invertible defect, which was studied by these authors. So since I'm out of time, let me summarize. We showed that UV translation can lead to eminent internal symmetries. And unlike emergent or accidental symmetries, they are exact at long distances. They are not violated by relevant operators. Typically, there are relevant operators that violate them, but these operators are not there. Nor are they violated by irrelevant operators. So they are just exact at long distances, and they emanate from lattice translation. Anomalies involving UV translation should be matched by something, and the way it matches, because even though there is no anomaly in translation in the continuum, is that the lattice translation gives us this internal symmetry, and we can have anomalies involving internal symmetries. A lot of known results in condensed matter physics can be phrased that way. The famous Lipschitz-Mattis theorem can be stated that way. There is an anomaly associated with translation on the lattice. This symmetry leads to an eminent Z2, and then in the continuum, it's such the Atuft anomaly matching is with this Z2 with some SO3. Similarly, some results about filling constraints, Luttinger theorem, and others can be phrased in that language. There's a new symmetry, it has an anomaly, can be traced microscopically, and it's saturated at long distances. Then specifically, we discussed four lattice Majorana chains. And in the continuum, they flow to four different Majorana systems. Ramon Ramon, Neve Schwartz, Neve Schwartz, Neve Schwartz Ramon, and Ramon Neve Schwartz. And we found a chiral fermion parity at long distances, and it emanates from lattice translation, and it is exact. Then we performed the GSO procedure. We summed over the spin structures, and we found three bosonic lattice models, the original Ising, the Z2 twisted Ising, and Ising with a D defect. And D is a new non-invertible symmetry of the lattice model. Everything, when I discuss here the lattice could be L as to be even or odd, and L could be small, L could be 5. We don't need to take any continuum limit. Everything I say is true only for a finite lattice. So D is an exact non-invertible symmetry of the lattice. And at long distances, these three different Ising models flow to three different Ising CFTs with the corresponding defects corresponding to the three primaries of the Ising model. One, the energy operator E, and the spin field sigma. And the non-invertible duality symmetry of the Ising CFT emanates from lattice translation, which using my color coding is this D. Thank you.
Hi, Nadi.
Hi, Dan. Good to see you.
Good to see you. In the examples you gave today, the lattice was very important. I wonder, do you know anything about, can you have a renormalization group flow from one continuum field theory to another, which has one of these eminent symmetries?
Yep. In fact, I mentioned it earlier. Any system that has a global U1 symmetry, scale a field theory in any number of dimensions with a global U1 symmetry, give it a chemical potential, and go to low energies, you're going to find an eminent symmetry with an anomaly. And the anomaly exists already microscopically. So if you just turn on a chemical potential, you can show that chemical potential is large, there's some fine print, there is an anomaly, which is surprising because the underlying model, I didn't say anything about anomalies of the models, could be a model of scalars. It's just a complex, a free complex scalar field with a chemical potential would do the job. And there's a new anomaly, and that anomaly has to be saturated at long distances, and it is saturated as an ordinary anomaly of a new internal symmetry at long distances. And that has a lot of consequences in the phenomenology.
Yeah. Can I also ask, when L is odd, what's the dimension of the Hilbert space?
For the fermions?
Yeah, for the
fermions. Okay, so that's an interesting question. So when, in general, you ask, when we're discussing quantum mechanics with an odd number of fermions, what do we do about this? The majority view is you go away.
Yeah,
you don't want to address this problem. It's confusing. There's kind of a taboo. This is not something that we discuss. That's the lore, and that was my attitude. Then if you're a little bit more sophisticated, you consider the functional integral, and you do that. I learned about it from Ed Witten years ago, but I saw it in print first time in the paper by Jome and Davide and their student, I think. Yeah. Who is, I think, now in Stony Brook. Great. So they did that. They said, let's square it. Now there's no problem. The number of fermions is even. We calculate the trace over the Hilbert space. We find a number. And now we take the square root, and the square root is not an integer, concluding that this does not give us a sensible Hilbert space interpretation. So this is option two. Option one is go away. Option two, you square it. Option three, you say you have a Hilbert space. What do we do here? And again, we have two options, three and four. One of them, we have some Clifford algebra, and we pretend to be Mr. Clifford. So when Mr. Clifford said, there is a Clifford algebra of an odd number of Clifford operators, and they give us a Hilbert space. So if L is odd, if it is three, there's a two-dimensional Hilbert space. The sigma matrices are an example. If L is five, there is a four-dimensional Hilbert space, and so on. Somebody else would say, no, I also want minus one to the F to be there. And there are various arguments why that would be a good thing to do. So they add a dummy fermion, which is not really there, making the total number of fermions even. And then when L is three, the dimensionality of the Hilbert space is four, not two. And if L is four, then the dimensionality of the Hilbert space is not four, but eight, et cetera, et cetera. So this is what you do. The approach we took here is the most conventional one. This is what Mr. Clifford did. We have an algebra. we have an odd number of fermions. They satisfy some algebra. And we want the smallest dimensional realization of this algebra. Now, you might want to embed that in a bigger problem by imposing more restrictions. And then you might end up with a larger Hilbert space.
But that's like there's secretly another Majorana, but you just kind of choose to forget about it. Is that?
No, I did not introduce it. No, I think the best way to say that.
The dimension you said is consistent.
I would say, I think this is a misleading way of thinking about it. The best way to think about it is to say that in this case, you look at the product of all the fermions. And this object for L even is minus 1 to the F. For L odd, it's central. So the operator algebra has a central element, which is the product of all these fermions. And since it is central, I just give it a value. And there's an ambiguity of the sign of it, and there are two ways to quantize it with the two different
signs. But then it's a reducible representation of the Majorana.
Sorry?
It's a reducible representation?
It's irreducible. I insist on working on with an irreducible representation.
Okay.
If you double the Hilbert space, it becomes a reducible representation.
Hi. Thank you for the fantastic talk. So I have a question about the anomaly matching. I think normally the statement is that the anomaly matching happens when a symmetry is preserved throughout the whole RG flow. And in the Majorana chain case, the mixed anomaly between the fermion priority and the discrete translation in the UV is matched with this minus 1 to the F and the eminent minus 1 to the FL. So since one is not the subgroup of the other, how is this in the
Because framework? You have to use, I gave you a dictionary how to relate one to the other. Use the dictionary and then you get this result.
So is this like matching in a more general sense? Or
it's anomaly matching in the most traditional sense, in the way Atuf described it in the summer of 79. There's an anomaly. We compute the same thing using the low lying degrees of freedom, and we get the same minus sign.
Yeah, there are some other lattice model which have a self-dual property. Whether all those self-dual lattice model have this immanent non-invertible symmetry, whether this kind of generalized to the self-dual lattice.
Okay, so I can interpret your question several different ways. One, what does the description I gave here have to do with self-duality? That's one question. And the answer is that very superficially, the self-duality of the Ising model is like a square root of translation that is never precise. And indeed, when you square the operator that we had, you indeed get translation, but we not quite get translation. We get translation times a projection operator. So in that sense, it's not quite that. Various people wrote down operators that are supposed to do the job. They are usually not operators acting in the same Hilbert space. There's an operator that map us from one Hilbert space to another Hilbert space, or they do not satisfy the correct boundary conditions. So every one of them has a problem. This construction doesn't have that problem.
Yeah, but whether
the other question you asked is about repeating that for other systems.
Yeah, that's
it. I know a number of people who are doing it for various systems. I myself am not in the details of that. I do not know whether in general, I believe the answer is that whenever you have self-duality, you can reproduce this thing as we done here. But here it was very easy because the self-duality was really associated with minus 1 to the F left. We knew exactly what it is. And that was a symmetry that we could see with the naked eye in the fermionic problem. So here, since the underlying fermionic problem is free and so easy to analyze, I just look at it, I know what the symmetry is, and then I processed it through the GSO projection to see what I land on.